Chapter 56. I looked up to your mother, Irene said. She took me under her wing when her own mother died. She knew I had no women to look up to. As an adult, I can see why else she was doing it, of course. Making peace between Milagos and Guile needn't take a marriage if your friendships are strong enough. But then something happened. Do you know what?
Gavin sat in his cell, looking at his captor through heavy-lidded eyes. This was their third visit over the past months. He'd lost two fingers from those meetings. One more and he wasn't going to have much grip in his left hand.
"Pray tell," he said.
His voice was gravelly. Hadn't been used much in weeks. She was letting him rot down here.
It wasn't a rhetorical question. Do you know what happened? One day, Felia Guile is visiting all the time, and inviting me to visit her, and then nothing. She refused to ever even talk to me again. What happened?
That strange intensity was suddenly back. The worst of it was that Gavin was slowly starting to believe that Irene Milagos wasn't insane. She was a normal woman driven to extremes by her circumstances, circumstances that the Guiles had much to do with.
I don't know,
Gavin said, rubbing his eyes, nearly scratching himself with his bandaged hand.
But I'm sure it was all my fault, somehow. How's it going, keeping your nephew silent?
This was 15 years ago. Think about it. Why would Felia Guile shut me out, suddenly, then?
Gavin fixed stupidity on his face and thought about it. It didn't take him long. First he thought it was the war, or his fraud. But that was 16 years ago now. 15 years ago was when Felia had learned that Dervani Milagos had survived the war, after being lost in the wilderness for years, and was making his way home, carrying Gavin's secret. She'd confessed at her freeing that she'd tried to buy him off, first, and then sent pirates to intercept his ship, murdering him, or so she thought. Felia Guile, willing to kill to protect her last living son, but not willing to face the daughter whose father she'd had murdered, and smile. That sounded like mother. Hard when she had to be, but soft underneath. Not like Andros Guile, who never would have thought to befriend a Milagos in the first place. But if he had, he would have played it to the hilt. This world has only two kinds of people, villains and smiling villains. Gavin said,
Of course I know why. Because I kept my silence about what happened at Sundered Rock from even her. For 2 years I told no one, and then she heard a rumour that your father was alive. She asked me about it because I'd made a passing reference at some point to him being dead. She asked if I could be mistaken.
He closed his eyes and blew out air, as if it were a painful memory.
And what did you tell her? Irene asked.
You dumb cunt. I'm going to enjoy killing you. You have no idea about me, do you? I'm going to tear your fingers off with chains and make you eat them.
I told her the man was an impostor. He wasn't the first or the last, with a lot of scars and wild tales, to come back to a wealthy estate to claim the empty seat at the table.
He wasn't an impostor,
Irene said. Yes, he was.
No, he wasn't.
And you know this how?
Gavin asked. He had the target now. The man had sent messages to Irene. Odds were they'd never met, though. He would have sent something to prove he was who he said, but perhaps it was something that could have been a forgery, or a fact that a close associate might have known.
I'll ask the questions.
No need to hold back, then. His story needn't be perfect, it merely had to cast doubt on the other. I am the father of lies. See my magnificence.
I know because I was there, Lady Irene. At the end, Dervani was close to Dazen.
True.
He was a good warrior.
True.
Not the most talented of drafters, but clever with his use of green Luxin.
True, if flattering. Some sugar of what the listener wants to hear helps a bitter lie go down.
He stood when many fell, in my brother's and my last clash.
First part was true, second part was not.
He was there, at Sundered Rock, at the end. He lived through the conflagration.
True, he had lived, and he had been at the battle. but he'd only lived because he'd not been near the centre at the end. No one had lived through that magical miasma except Dazen and Gavin. Devani charged me at the end, trying to save Dazen. He died heroically. Pure fabrication.
You lie, she said.
Gavin looked away, looked back at her, pursed his lips.
He tried. He charged me, knocked me over. He pointed a pistol at my face and it misfired. When I rose, I disarmed him and he broke. I grabbed a javelin and threw it through his back as he ran away. I didn't see his body afterward, but I've seen a lot of battle. He didn't live through that. I guarantee it. I then picked up that pistol, little thing, decorated with silver sparrows, if I remember right. Must have been a backup pistol. Be the only reason it was still loaded that late in the battle. No bigger than my hand. Odd thing in the middle of a battlefield. There were no damned weapons handy except that javelin and that pistol. I couldn't bear to draft the least Luxon at that moment, and my brother was barely conscious. I took that little pistol, and I put it between my brother's eyes. It didn't misfire for me.
The dead look on my face doesn't have to be painted on. It's close enough to truth to bring those memories close to the surface again. The detail about Devani's pistol was particularly good. How would Gavin know of a small secondary pistol, carried by one of Dazen's retainers?
No,
Irene whispered.
No.
My mother didn't understand. She never saw battle. She thought running away made your father a coward. Truth is, every man only gets so much heroism to spend in a day. And your father had far more than most. He charged two warring gods and would have made all the difference if he hadn't been betrayed by a broken flint. When he charged me, he didn't know I couldn't draft any more, and after what he'd seen me do, it was brave indeed. But more than that, my mother couldn't allow herself to hate me for killing my brother. I was all she had left. So she blamed your father. She thought that if he hadn't brought that pistol into my hand, her other son would still be alive. I think she knew, rationally, that it wasn't fair to blame him, and by extension your family, but she did. She knew she could keep herself from acting on the hatred she felt for you, for me, really, but she couldn't keep a pleasant mask on her face while she did it. She might even have been right. I wonder, sometimes, if I would have taken my brother prisoner if there had only been that javelin there. Or would I have rammed that through his throat? The pistol made it easier, but it's an idle fancy. I was in a killing mood. My mother blamed your father and probably believed that you would blame her in turn, if you knew the truth of what I had done.
You demon,
Irene said. If it makes you feel better, I'm sorry that my brother's war cost you your mentor, in addition to all else. By Orholm's beard, I'd give two fingers to have your father back. He wiggled his half hand at her. Caris, you told me once that there was something in me that wanted my own destruction. I denied it. I was a fool.
Fuck you! Burn in hell!
One thing I knew about Devani, he wasn't a man to torture the helpless. Stubborn, they said, but honourable. He's got that on you. It seemed like a stupid thing to do, antagonize a woman whom he'd just told such lies. But you have to let the fish swallow the hook if you want it to set right. If he was angry enough to say something so obviously stupid to her face, surely he couldn't also be so coldly cunning at the same moment to weave a flawless fabric of lies, could he? She stared at him, silent, arms folded, almost hugging herself, face inscrutable. But Gavin had to play a bigger game. What was happening under the surface here was the real test. Irene was the real power in Hrothgar. The satrapa, Euterpe Ptolos, was under her thumb. Irene's father, Devani, had joined the Colour Prince. Whatever else the man had been doing for 16 years, and it had been Devani, Gavin had recognized the man, if not immediately, whatever else he'd done in the intervening years, Devani had thrown in his lot with the pagans at the end. By driving a wedge between Irene and her father, Gavin was really serving the seven satrapies. For if Irene's hatred blotted out all else, she might drag Hrothgar over to the Colour Prince's side. Such a move would be stupid beyond belief. Those at the top have nothing to gain in a revolution like the Colour Prince was proposing. Inviting an aggrieved army into your city? You shouldn't even invite a friend's army into your cities. But hatred and envy birth self-destruction in every heart that gives them a bed to breed in. To dislodge the guiles, this woman without children might be willing to risk losing all her family owned as well. So I lie, in service of the greater good, as always. Still she stared. There was nothing to be gained now. If she felt pushed into a decision, she'd doubt it in the future. Whatever action she took, she had to feel that it was hers, and inevitable with what she knew. Then it would be irreversible, and their alliance unbreakable. The fingers? She might never pay for that, or at least not for a long time. Gavin would have to bank the coals of his rage, let them glow warm under the earth. Someday. Maybe. But not today. Not soon. He didn't hold her gaze. He looked at her, glanced away, looked back, easing his shoulders into a slump as if he felt exposed. Not a challenge. It was important to let her think this through. Finally, she said, "After the wars, my family had estates everywhere, but many of them had been devastated. They required huge piles of gold to restore, tens of thousands of dinars to import vines for the vineyards, to buy new slaves for the cotton fields, to pay the tuitions of drafters and indenture them afterward, to rent and then finally to buy the river barges to transport our goods, new axes for logging, iron for the brackets of new water wheels, millstones which, if cut from local softer stone, would cost half as much but only last a third as long, versus those we shipped in. But every time I would do my calculations in my father's ledgers, actually the ledgers my father's steward Melanthes kept, but he died during the Blood War, every time I would see these line items, cost of hired guards, and sometimes bribes to Blood Forest cons, and losses to pirates, and at the end of the year, repairs for damage from raids, and replacement drafters from raids. Eventually, of course, I filled those ledgers and moved on to new ones, but I left those columns. And I studied what those costs had been. Old Melanthes was our steward for 45 years, and he could predict those costs within a few points per hundred after a while. When you know you're going to lose 1 boat in 10 when they make a Tyrian orange run, you know what sort of profit you need to make in order to justify trying next year. Over time, it matters. My father never realized that Melanthes was the real reason we even had estates by the time the False Prisms War and the Blood War were finished, though we lost too many sons and daughters. She took a deep breath. But every time I picked up those ledgers to make a decision about shipping this or that, I saw those costs. I haven't had to pay those. I'm very good with numbers, and I've compared my numbers to Melanthes's. And what I've learned, what I can never deny when I see those columns laid out before me, is that I owe you, Gavin Gyle. How much is a matter of what assumptions I make. For though those parts per hundred losses are unyielding, I would have lost men and treasure to raids and murder and piracy at some point regardless, when I might have lost them matters most. If you lose a prize stallion and a mare from a herd of hundreds, it stings. If you lose them before you ever breed the herd, it destroys you. So I worked my abacus many different ways and calculated what I could. I chose not to quantify any emotional toll of losing family members or trusted servants and slaves. I also found it impossible to quantify the merely possible but significant cost of my own lost time, should enough of my own close family have been killed that I would have had to marry and bear my own children. Women in my family have tended to have quick recoveries, but it was impossible to calculate how many pregnancies I might have suffered, or exactly how much work I might have been able to do while in the late stages of pregnancy or early stages of recovery. And, of course, I didn't assign any value to not having to marry or bear children, as I now don't. Given my present wealth, I would pay a great deal more for such a privilege than I would have were circumstances quite different. You see, you present me with conundrums. You may have lost me somewhere in there, Gavin said. He thought he followed, but it was rarely a mistake to make an enemy think they were smarter than you. Because you stopped the war, Gavin, and then you wiped out the pirates, several times,
and that's without crediting you for taxes falling because there was no longer a war to finance. One way or another, Gavengal, your family cost me my father, my last uncle, and 4 distant cousins. But from my calculations, I owe you somewhere between 4 years and 23 days to 27 years and 16 days, years of my labour, years of my life. You've saved me perhaps 1,000 dinars. You've allowed me to re-establish my family, and by stopping the blood war, you have certainly saved me the blood of many people I love. I want to kill you so badly that my stomach aches, and I've been getting the kind of headaches that would bring an empire low just thinking about you. I am well known, perhaps famous, for dealing straight. I've never cheated anyone, though it has been in my power to do so for quite some time. But how does one balance blood?
I leave a complicated legacy, Gavin said dryly.
One balances blood with blood, she said.
Oh, that was a rhetorical question, Gavin said. But you seem both far too grim and far too elated at my suffering to be about to say, Gavin, you've saved lives I love, so I will save yours.
Whatever else you are, and you are many things, Gavin Garr, you're not stupid. Did you hear about the Battle of Oxford?
I was busy. Felt like I was stuck rowing in endless circles. Missed it.
The Cromeria lost 55,000 men in one day. 35,000 of those were Hrothgari. My people.
Gavin felt like he'd been kicked.
What happened?
General Asmuth thought to crush the Colour Prince against the Isle River.
The Isle?
That river's not that deep, is it? Gavin asked. Deep enough during the wet season.
Gavin had only seen the river in summer.
The general tried to catch the blood robes as they crossed the ford. Their white drafters drafted new bridges within half an hour, encircled our armies and crushed us against the river instead. The blood foresters hated the plan and had sworn to withdraw, but General Asmuth wasn't moved. He went ahead without them. So the Colour Prince invaded Blood Forest, and Blood Forest lost no one, while my people took a blow from which we may not recover.
My people. She said it not as a native daughter, but as a leader. She must own Satrapa Ptolus outright. But that wasn't the worst of it. With the battles of Rue and Oxford, the 7 satrapies had endured 2 military disasters in a row. Even with the riches of Hrothgar, a satrapy could only stand to lose so many lives.
Nor have things gotten better. After Oxford, he split his armies and sent half up around the headwaters of the Io, trying to cut off their supply lines.
That was a long trip, and a long time to be without half your army. Gavin would have sent small parties across the river to raid, not half his army.
General Asmuth entreated Raven Rock to hold out, told them that he would save them. They held, but he got there too late. He fled in disarray, leaving behind cannons and gunpowder and whole wagons full of rations and muskets.
Clearly, there's only one thing you can do, Gavin said.
And what's that?
Free me.
And why would I do that?
Because I win battles. Because if you want to keep track of debts owed in blood, then the Colour Prince owes you most dearly.
I don't know about that. I think the blood debt is yours.
Mine? Gavin asked with real incredulity.
How could those lives possibly be put on me? You let this war happen. You could have stopped it in Garriston or long before then.
What?
What? Everything I've done to stop this war. How bad are your spies if you believe anything else? You're a liar, Gavin Gale. They all agree on that.
It was one thing to be killed for your sins, many as they were. It was something else altogether to be killed for the very thing you'd been trying to stop. He tried another tack.
Do you remember your number? In the lottery?
157. Everyone remembers their Orholm-damned number. 2 days with that damned thing folded in my hand, wondering if it would mean my death. The lottery had been a furious young Gavin's way to end the interminable blood war. Only the leading families on both sides had been given numbers. 2,000 of the richest and most connected people in Blood Forest and Hrothgar had been gathered at Gavin's command. His blackguards had apoplectic fits at the very thought of it. Not that that stopped him. Gavin had invited them all to the Hippodrome to pray for peace. Attendance was not voluntary. No drafters were allowed in except those who were members of the families, and Gavin's blackguards had relieved each person of larger weapons, though knives and the like for personal defence had been allowed, allaying their suspicions. The heads of all the families understood you didn't want swords and ataghans and spears when you gathered bitter enemies in one place. Each family had lined up in a column according to their number. A random number, so they thought. Felia Gael had helped Gavin decide who should be in the front ranks. She'd also helped with the deception itself. Gavin had marked each folded slip of paper with a superviolet number as each person dropped it in. Felia had worn Lucidonius's superviolet spectacles around her neck, though no one knew they were that, and fewer still would have known what those spectacles did. With her head bowing as if in prayer each time she reached into the bowl, she'd looked through the spectacles and grab out the appropriate paper. It worked for all but one family who had swapped their folded papers. Younger and angrier, Gavin had merely shrugged and said, "They want to lie to the prism? So the wind." His mother knew how the saying ended. She'd acquiesced. With the columns of families facing him in a circle, with only the lowest number from each family standing in the narrowest circle facing Gavin, he had gestured to a large circular wooden table he'd placed on the raised spina with him. He had led a prayer for peace, some drivel he didn't remember, after they'd all agreed to his sufficiently abstract and non-binding words to Orholm, bobbing their heads and making the sign of the seven, he'd gestured to that rough-hewn round table beside him. "My friends," he said, "here sits the table of peace. In the blessed light of Orholm, who will join me at it?" One family, the Blue Bells, had sent their mother forward. The Blue Bells had once been numerous and fierce. Now they were a shadow. Two daughters, two distant cousins left, and not much land, no riches. They were within a breath of being commoners or being extinct. Everyone else looked to their lady or lord, Bancon or Con. Gavin said, "I think you all don't understand. Your war has stripped your lands bare. It has soaked every field in unclean blood, with each act rivaling the next in baseness and inhumanity. Your war is an affront to Orholm. All this you know, but your bloodlust is greater than your shame. You daren't ask forgiveness for your atrocities, because then you might have to extend forgiveness for your enemies. Your bitterness is a boil on your faces, obscuring your sight. So every year you send a tribute of your sons and daughters to death, so you can continue your foolishness and pride, and every year you send a far greater tribute of those who have been pulled in the wake of your impiety, your blasphemy, your arrogance. You have not only insulted Orholm, you have insulted me. You have not only robbed your own families and your enemies' families and the innocent, you have robbed the seven satrapies. You have had satraps, and yes, even prisms come to you, and to your fathers, to stop these wars. You have responded with temporary truces and lies, lulls in which you rearm and breed, picking sons and daughters based on who might be the strongest drafter, who might have the most colours. I know, yes, I am the product of this breeding myself. But now I am prism, and what I do today isn't for my family, it is for the seven satrapies. Today your war is finished. Now I ask again, will any join me at the table of peace?" He swept his hand, as if in invitation toward them. None did. Gavin, who moved the world on the fulcrum of his desires, Gavin, loser and leader, drafter, deceiver, exile, executioner, Gavin was being ignored. He stared at the sun as if praying. It was one of those white-hot days. The Delta air was thicker than blood, the sounds of the city coming in even to the centre of the Hippodrome. He prayed, but he wasn't praying. He was filling himself with power. "So be it," Gavin said. He swept his hand again, and this time blue Luxin spikes shot out along the superviolet guide wires he'd placed at the throats of each man and woman in the first rank of the circle. Through the centre of each throat, and into the centre of each spine. The front person in each family's column dropped dead. It was so sudden, so stark and brutal, and so quiet that no one said a word. Many didn't even know why the people had fallen. "War seems so random," Gavin shouted. "Does it not? Who lives, who dies? It's like a lottery. But in my lottery, only you who are responsible for this war will die. I think the common folk will prefer this greatly.
Now, who will join me at the table of peace?"
For a moment, shock prevailed as every family looked at their dead. In each case, Orcholam had picked the most pugnacious, the bitterest, the most hateful or guiltiest person in the whole family to be first in line. Some families had to be happy to be rid of their most troublesome member, and far more so to see the worst of the other families die. But these were families bred to war, in many cases literally so.
"Are you insane?" a willow asked. "You killed my father," a 16-year-old, fiery-haired green apple shouted.
Damned blood foresters and their tempers. The young man pulled out his belt dagger, a wild look in his eyes.
"Your father was a fool, and you'll be a dead fool if you attack me," Gavin told him.
"Ah!"
the young man charged the platform. Some people simply don't react well to surprise. Gavin astounded everyone by turning his back.
"There's no need for anyone else to die," he shouted.
Behind his back, the rising young blackguard watch captain Ironfist materialized from nowhere and cut the young man down before he reached Gavin. It was so nonsensical that Gavin was swept into sudden fury.
"Sit at the goddamn table and no one else needs to die," he roared.
Another pulse, and another row of men and women died. He'd almost forgotten the sound of projectiles thunking into human flesh. They broke and fled across the sands. He'd known they would, the damned cowards, like he'd never set up an ambush in the course of the Prism's War. He still thought of it as the Prism's War, as the losers did, though he didn't think he'd failed once to call it the false Prism's War when he spoke of it. He was so furious he thought of waiting until they were in its teeth to trigger the trap. No, enough killing. The point was to shock them into submission, not to turn the few survivors against him forever. He reached into the superviolet he'd laid under the sand out in a great ring and pushed Luxin into it hard. A great spike-toothed ring of death leapt out of the sand in a fence around all the nobles. Green and blue and yellow Luxin twined, shivered, begged the nobles to impale themselves on the barbs. The nobles tripped over each other, literally falling and smashing into each other as they stopped. Beyond the glowing wall of death, blocking each exit from the hippodrome, they saw stony-eyed blackguards, weapons unsheathed, in the loose, easy posture of killers, Luxin readied.
"No one else need die," Gavin shouted. "Get back to your lines."
His blackguards and the drafters he'd brought echoed his command, circling outside the wall, bellowing at the people inside.
"Back to your line! Now, move!"
Others were gentler, but the result was the same. In minutes, the lines had reformed. "Now," more quietly, Gavin said, "would you rather die than have peace? No one else in your family or on your lands has to die."
"If I take your offer," one grandmother said, "I'll be setting myself against all of them. How is my little family to stand against the might of the willows on one side and the Malargosses on the other?"
"Whoever takes my peace gains my protection," Gavin said. "Whoever breaks my peace gains swift and brutal death."
He swept a hand slowly across the columns, and this time set glowing yellow targets where the next missiles would fly. In the front of many of the columns were children, or favourite aunts, favourite sons. Orcholam forgive the families if they were too stubborn even now. Orcholam forgive him. He held the tense silence until someone was about to speak, and then he swung a hand so fast at the table that the entire crowd flinched, thinking it another attack. He sent out waves of sub-red, so that the air around him shimmered, a trick he'd honed in the war to make it look like he was radiating power, and roared, pointing at the table.
"This is the end of your war! Who will sit?"
Over the bodies of the dead obstinate and the dead murderers and the dead proud, they made peace. It hadn't been easy, but it had been quick. Not all justice could be done. How far back does one go with judgment? After what horror in the chain does one say, "All before this is forgiven"? But peace had been forged.
Hostages were exchanged, and hostages were sent to the Chromeria, where Gavin would have personal oversight of them.
In the years that followed, a test of the Prism's peace had come, of course. It had come from a Guile cousin, Marcos Sebastian Guile, who had exacted vengeance for a wartime rape in like fashion, doubtless thinking his blood connection to Gavin gave him extra leeway. If he'd had a shred of the Guile intellect, he'd have known it meant exactly the opposite. Marcos Sebastian had been found mutilated in the town square, limbs piled neatly nearby, a sign propped under his bloody chin. So too to all who break the prism's peace. And later, Gavin had needed to send an emissary to a Hrothgari lord using his economic might to ruin one of his vassals who'd turned on him early that day. That had required only a stern talk. Blood and words. Peace by sword and will. Irene Malagos had been the first of the heads of the most powerful families to sign. Now, Gavin said to her, do you think that lottery was random? Your uncle Pericles was a warrior coward, happy to take insult, happy to send men to die, but would never dare the line himself, and his wife Thera? You think that vicious heifer had it in her to lead a great family to a picnic, much less to a peace? Think of those who died that day. They were, except that regrettable young green apple idiot with the knife, exactly the people who couldn't countenance peace, or who had done such horrific things the other families couldn't countenance peace while they lived. If that was Orholm's hand, it was his hand working through me, and my mother. It was she who helped me sift the nobles and the cons and the bankons. Only she knew them all well enough to know. She selected you, Irene. Do you remember the moment at the table when they wanted you to be the hostage at the Cromeria because Tisus was too young? My mother picked you to lead your family. Your lottery number was her choice, so you can decide if you owe me everything or nothing. But your life and your position, those you owe to my mother. Irene's eyes were damp, and Gavin didn't know if she was thinking of those who died that day, or her father who'd died before, or all that she had lost in leading her family, or whether she was thinking about Felia Guile and the friendship of that great woman that she'd been deprived of. Did she speak of me? At the end? The most tempting lies are often best shunned. It proves your honesty. Gavin shook his head slowly. I'm sorry. Our time was very limited. The Colour Prince was almost literally at the door, and we had a city to defend. It was an abbreviated freeing at best. And he had her. By Orholm's beard, he had her. He was going to claw his way up out of this cell and out of this country, and he was going to climb the heavens. He would fell the sun. There was nothing Gavin Guile couldn't do. He was not only his magic. He was a man unlike any other man who'd ever gone before. He was a man to rival Lucidonius himself. He was a god. Lady Malagos, set me free. I will win this war, and I will repay every debt you are owed, and I will make the Colour Prince pay in blood. But then the door opened, and of all people, of all the real Gavin's old friends and lovers and enemies and those who were all three in a singular body, the Nukaba walked in. She was dressed in the casual style that a Parian lady would usually only wear in her own home, among her ladies and eunuchs. And that she was dressed so here told Gavin that she was an honoured guest and a close friend of Irene Malagos. She wore jewelled slippers, women's loose mid-calf-length trousers secured with a multi-folded brocade belt with long fringe, a light blouse open in the front and a vest snug about the bust, decorated with precious stones matching those on a number of necklaces, and a loose scarf about her hair. She wore the small tattoos of her position as Nukaba, almost invisible against her rich, black skin. One just below her lower lip, and one under each eye in decorative old Parian script. Under the left eye it read, Cursed Accuser, and under the right, Blessed Redeemer. Greetings, Gavin, the leader of Paria said. Do you know what this is? She held up a metallic chain with a large jewel on it like living fire captured in amber. This is the seed crystal of the Orange Bane. Among other things, it detects lies. And you glorious fuck, you are a liar.